And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. The Reverend Albert Williams, the pastor of the Stanton. Am I saying, is it Stanton or Stanton?
Stanton.
Stanton. Memorial CME Church in Pittsburgh was honored a few days ago at the Martin Luther King Day celebrations. He was awarded the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Service Award, and this is by the NAACP.
NAACP.
And they caught you by surprise, didn't they,
by
Reverend?
Totally surprised.
Well, what did you sitting back? Are you sitting? You're a minister, so you're sitting on the stage, I guess.
I was on the program.
You were on the program.
To introduce the speaker.
To introduce the representative from Durham.
From Durham, Mr. Larry Dwight Hall.
And so you introduced him, or did they catch you before you introduced him, or after you introduced him?
They caught me before I introduced him, which just drained me from thoughts.
So you're sitting up there kind of getting your notes together to introduce Representative Hall, and then what happened?
And I was kind of getting into the atmosphere of the occasion. My brother and fellow firefighters were there as flag bearers, and that was so moving. They were honoring all of the veterans of military services, and I was involved in helping to schedule that.
So you were deeply involved in the program. That went off all right.
And it went off through the ministerial, the Chapel Hill Carver Ministerial Alliance. And I was given the task to introduce the speaker.
Well, that's an honor. That's an honor for Martin Luther King.
It was.
So you got to worry about doing that. You got that on your fire. The honor guard thing went well.
Honor guard detail.
They you're came sitting there up. Dreaming, what am I going to, if I got this right, if I got all my
that's
facts
right,
what am I going to say? Is it too long? Is it too short?
Uh-huh.
And then, so out of the blue, you're not even listening to see who's going to get the award.
That's right. I'm kind of overseeing because my church choir was there and my church musicians were there, plus two other groups. And we were all trying to position ourselves, make sure we were in the right spot and all. And I hadn't had the opportunity to meet the speaker. So through all of these transitions and activities and all, and, you know, all these things, I was just totally, totally shocked, lost the words, and I couldn't even think at the time.
Well, that's great. Well, I mean, grew up in Chapel Hill and went to school here and went to school during sort of maybe, I guess, right before or right as the schools were opening up. You graduated in 1962, but you graduated from Lincoln.
From Lincoln High School.
And some people in Chapel Hill don't know where Lincoln High School was or is.
And it's on South Mert Mill Road. It's the school administration building now where they play soccer field. And I think part of the Chapel Hill Carver school system maintenance shop is down on the land also.
So you're like many of us in this generation, you were right there before desegregation really took place.
Yes, before desegregation.
And anybody who's just tuning in, we're going to talk a lot about Reverend Williams' career and his background, and some of the salient parts of it are what he's doing now as a minister. Maybe an even more interesting part is what it was like to be the first full-time black firefighter in our community. And so we're going to talk about all those things. What was the as you remember it, you probably not sure exactly what they said when they were saying they were honoring you, but were they honoring you for your work as a firefighter and chaplain of the fire department, or as a full-time minister now?
Well, it was inclusive of all. My life being born and raised in Chapel Hill, my total life from the high school days The civil rights struggle started in 59, 60. The Colonial Drugstore, I was among the first ones to protest, where we could always go in and buy things, but we didn't have the privilege to sit down and eat. And we knew the drugstore owner, Mr. John Coswell, and we knew his wife and family. It was like one big community. Everybody pretty much knew everybody. And so being in high school with the civil rights demonstration that started, you know, with the bus sit-downs, we experienced some of the Freedom Riders coming through Chapel Hill, which stopped at First Baptist Church, where Dr. J.R. Manning was the pastor there. And that kind of excited the community, yet there were a lot of reservations because of maybe violence and retaliation.
Well, and as you were just mentioning, since you're protesting the Colonial Drugstore, but you're friends with the owner, so you're having to confront your friends in a way.
That's right, acquaintances, you know, because Ms. Caldwell, anybody in the community that needs some type of medication, and I mean, he was like a doctor to the community in recommending certain things, and I know many of the people that patronize his business, he would tell them, you need to go to the doctor and get checked out, then come back, and we'll take care of you, like that. So, you know, you're dealing with a different generation.
No, that's right, but that's the story of, I think, an underreported story of the civil rights movement in a small community like Chapel Hill was, that here you are, you're going into protest what a friend is doing, or what an acquaintance, you know, somebody that you know and who's been good in the context of the times of what the, and you're having to say, look, we may like you, but the time has come to change.
To change.
I mean, and then he comes back and says, yeah, but if I change, I'm going to lose all my customers. And he tells you all his troubles, and you're just a high school student, and you say, well, you're caught up in the thing. But do you get mad with him, or do you say he's our buddy, but we got to change him? What was going through your mind?
Right. Well, it was something that we were challenged to do. You had to do it because it was right to do what was right, irregardless of the relationship. And this is part of the bond, part of the way that we were brought up in the community. The saying that it takes a village to raise a child, we've always lived that concept in our community in Chapel Hill, even in the white community. You know, many of our parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles worked for the university professors and different professional people in the community, even school teachers. From a domestic.
Sort of like this, everybody's talking still about the movie The Help and the book The Help, which showed African-American women primarily raising white kids. That was part and parcel of what was going on in Chapel Hill, too.
Absolutely. You know, for instance, my grandmother, who deceased now, raised me, Clander Henley, worked, was one of the maids for the Mr. R.B. House and his family, who, helped raise his children. And when the university would close during the summer, my grandmother would go down to the beach in South Carolina and stay with that family for about 2 weeks. And that left me home by myself with some instructions, the do's and the don'ts. And the neighbors helped look out, you know, for me. I was...
So while the caretaking parent or grandparent was taking care of the white children, maybe even on vacation, the African-American community kind of rallied around to be sure that somebody was taking care of
the children. Absolutely. Yes. And and we well respected our neighbors because many of us went to church together and they worked together, you know, and all had everything in common.
Well, you were listening with the Reverend Albert Williams talking about it in the context of the recent award to him of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Service Award by the NAACP here in Chapel Hill, and he and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, visiting with the Reverend Albert Williams. He was recently awarded the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Service Award, all that in the context of the Martin Luther King Day celebrations, march, and service at the First Baptist Church. And so I'm just exploiting him. I'm using this as an occasion sort of to find out something about the history. We talked about your activity as you were in high school at Lincoln High School, and right about the time that the civil rights protests and demonstrations and efforts began to take place in Chapel Hill. But you're going to school at Lincoln. You're proud of Lincoln High School. You're on football team. You know, best school in the world. You're thinking
very proud.
Did you have mixed feelings about pushing for desegregation when you knew that desegregation was going to mean going to school with white people and losing a community institution? That didn't even hit you at this time.
That never hit me or us at that time, because the question we had as students when school season started, why can't we get new books? Why do we have to always receive books from the old Chapel Hill High School, which was on Franklin Street, where University Square is now? And I was a part of the detail that got on the truck and went down and picked the books up and brought them back to Lincoln. So if we had to pay book fees, we started questioning our principal and our teachers, who was Mr. C.A. McDougall, and he didn't like to be questioned by the students, you know.
So you're thinking, well, now let me push Albert, let me push you on this just a little bit. So you're thinking more in terms of the quality and the equal division of resources rather than pushing to desegregate the schools.
That's right. We wanted to be recognized and get new things also. For instance, like on the football team, we when Coach Jim Tatum was coach at Carolina, one of our community leaders, we refer to Mr. Morris Mason, was very, very instrumental in talking to Coach Tatum about getting equipment from Carolina. We got Carolina shoes. We got Carolina helmets. We got their body pads. And we thought we were somebody with Carolina, you know, through Mr. Morris Mason, because he was one of the trainers, equipment managers there at Carolina.
And he was an African-American guy?
African-American.
So he was on the staff and had an inside connection with the coach.
Yes.
He said, I got these boys over at Lincoln, mm-hmm. and they're good boys, and they don't get the same kind of equipment as they do at Chapel Hill High, so can you help us?
That's right. And somehow we started getting shoes and, you know.
This is what I'm getting at. Like right now, you know, the Chapel Hill School's desegregated, and you got African-American stars on every basketball and football team. But you weren't thinking about that. I mean, you weren't thinking about, I would be much happier if I were playing with white team, or were you thinking, I'm very happy playing with my black team if they just give me the right stuff, because we got a great group of kids here. We got a better team.
See, and we didn't have the money in the school system to purchase equipment. And we couldn't buy it from our own pockets, you know, a lot of time our families did good to have lunch money and the regular fees and have, you know, good clothes to go to school.
Well, now at this same time, Reverend, you were talking about Reverend J.R. Manley, who's been a leader in the community for 1,000 years from beginning to serve on the school board and beginning to fight for desegregation, for giving black kids who wanted to go to the white schools the opportunity to go, and ultimately to get the schools desegregated. And did this effort have full support in the black community?
It did. It had full support, but people were very cautious because of the relationship and ties with the white community. And as we think about it, they wanted us to be very much in order, very much nonviolent, non-threatening. This is the makeup of the Chapel Hill community. You know, Carver was a little different.
Oh, really? How's that?
Well, as far as segregation, you had some Carver citizens were not so much in favor of all of these things.
More conservative in Carver in terms of racial.
Very much so, because I remember at night when it would get dark across the railroad tracks at Carver, that separates. Mm-hmm. Unless you lived in Carver, you really had no business in Carver after dark. You know, this was a generally accepted thing because even the police would stop you. I remember when I had the opportunity to get my first car. It was a 1948 Plymouth. And we worked on it in the shop. We learned how to work on cars under R.D. Smith in our shop at Lincoln that was part of our project. And we put a motor in that car, and the first time I got stopped for a stop sign, the police officer, I remember him well, Officer Albert Pendergraft, I think was Lindy Pendergraft's father.
My golly.
And see, all the communities are close.
What did he say? What did Officer Pendergraft say to you when he pulled you over and said you ran a stop sign?
I ran a stop sign. I didn't come to a complete stop. And, he arrested me and carried me out to the little jail in Carver. And being a teenager, I gave him a rough time.
Of course. What did you say to him? So you wouldn't haul anybody else in just for a stop sign. You'd give him a citation.
I went right on. And the moment that he opened the jail to put me in jail, that's where I refused. I just grabbed the jail and wouldn't go in, and he pushed me. And all of a sudden, he was going to get ready to take his billy club and hit me upside the head. And I said, well, do what you have to do. I'm not going in there, because there were some other people in there, and a gentleman had, you know, vomited all over the floor. Mm. And, you know, I wasn't going in there. So I didn't. Somebody intervened that knew me and knew him and said, this is a bad thing. Just don't do it, because you didn't dare resist the authorities then. You know, being young, we were... You know, those growing years.
We were
taught to do things right and also respect those that were in authority, you know.
Well, what were when you finished Lincoln High in 1962, or there about 1962, and you looked around, the civil rights movement's getting started, looks like things are changing. What did you see as your opportunities for work or for further education? How did you size up, you know, graduate from high school? You'd say, well, where am I going to go to college?
Emphasis in our school system were put on those students really that had good grades. I wasn't the one that had such good grades. I think I maybe was maybe a good C-plus student.
So you weren't an academic star that the teachers were saying, oh, we got to get him to college. They were saying, what are we going to find for this guy?
That's right. I was a potential because I played football and scholarships were available. And, you know, those growing years, I was like some of the young people then. Now, I had a kind of a attitude.
He's one of those with
That's
an attitude.
Right,
an
attitude.
I can hear that. I can hear that echo right now.
And I had good people around me. And
so, what are your adult? I mean, how does an adult teacher or minister with a 1962 kid who's got an attitude? They say this is a good kid, but he's got an attitude. How do they counsel you? Do they say, look, we got to live in this world as it is, not as, and so don't ruin your life by causing a lot of trouble that you can't get out of. Or did they just give up on you? How did they counsel you?
No, we had a system where they would counsel you and lay things out, and you had to serve. We had what was recognized as a upper class system. You had to be the example of the student or the class that was behind you. And it was very, very effective. You had upperclassmen that you had to respect. You were taught to respect, you know. And if you played football, you had to, be disciplined and carry good grades or play in the band, high school band, or any of these other extracurricular activities, you see. And it was kind of a show and tell type situation.
Did you have a mentor, your football coach or your other teachers who would guide you?
They would have the, what do we call it, girls' assembly, then the boys' assembly, where the lady teachers would take off the girls, and talk from health talk to things like that. And the boys would do the men teachers would do the same thing to us boys. And the one that sticks out in my mind was was R.D. Smith, Mr. R.D. Smith. He was the ruler, and he would teach us sharp and how to be a man. And he would even, on the football team, he would give us, if you scored a touchdown or extra point, for extra points, you would get 50 cents, and for a touchdown, you would get a dollar. I mean, that was his little incentive.
And that was a lot of money back then.
that was it, And then you were expected to set a good example for other students.
Well.
And
we got to take a break.
Okay.
I'm visiting with Reverend Albert Williams, and we might be off topic a little bit, but we're doing this in the context of his recent award from the NAACP here in our community, the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Service Award. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with the Reverend Albert Williams, and we're talking about Chapel Hill in the old days. Right now, he's the minister of the Staunton Memorial CME Church in Pittsburgh, but still a resident of Orange County. I hope I got that right, Reverend Williams. You're still part of the Chapel Hill community as well.
Both communities, yes.
We got so much more. I'm sorry, I've gotten off track. I love this, the discussion about the borderline, and I want that is between the time of total segregation and the time of the opening up, which you experienced in person. But one of the things that happened is that after you graduated from high school, I think you left and went to the Army.
I left and went to the Army.
And one day I want to get together with you and talk about that experience, which must have been fun. So you were gone from Chapel Hill for 2 or 3 years and came back. And how was Chapel Hill different between 1962 and 1965?
It had changed drastically because of the integration of the schools. Lincoln had been was being phased out. Teachers were being transferred to the Chapel Hill school system. We were losing really a lot that we were used to and accustomed to and really loved, the Lincoln High School teachers, staff, and the our alma mater song and all. It was, we were like one big family. And
well,
didn't
were there
realize
anybody,
it.
Anybody in the black community just say, listen, this is not what we wanted. You know, we want good resources, but we don't want to give up Lincoln High School.
That's right. I don't think we really understood it in that context.
Uh-huh.
The future implications of what we had to give up. You know, they, it appears that they wanted us to give up everything that we had accomplished.
Do it the white people saying, okay, you've pushed your way in, now you got to learn to do it our way.
Do it our way, you know. So that's what happened. They took all of our trophies, pictures, the history, and they ended up at the landfill. And a few was able to be salvaged, but...
Well, now, you come back and the community's not happy about that development. But at the same time, you come back and some of the facilities that have been closed to you are beginning to open up a little bit?
Opened, yes, yes.
I mean, did that make any real difference to you? Were you, could you, you say, well, okay, we've accomplished that. This is changing. I mean, was it really different when you got back, or was it pretty much the same in terms of whether you could go to the drugstore or whether you could go to the restaurants?
It was much different. Things were open and opening up. For instance, the Long Meadow Dairy Farm, where everybody got their ice cream, particularly on Sunday. I even remember I got a whooping by my grandmother. I took money that I was supposed to be putting in Sunday school, and I skipped Sunday school and went to the dairy.
Well, that was when it was still segregated, but you could buy ice cream. Could you sit down?
You couldn't sit at Long Meadow Dairy Farm.
But now when you got back and you've had this Army experience, and the Army, of course, at least is about the same time I was in the Army. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. There were some problems, but it was totally different from what my experience in my Southern community was. It was integrated. I mean, and there were no legal distinctions there. So, for me coming back into the South, it was a little bit of a shock to say, "Hey, well, in the Army we got along okay, and we did the same." Then come back home, and it's not exactly that way. How did you find Chapel Hill when you got back after being in the Army?
I found it had made much progress and opened. There were meetings going on in the community as far as race relations and all. Number one thing with me was getting a job.
Yeah, well, tell us about that. Now, you know, we hadn't mentioned this for a while, but you're the first full-time black firefighter in our community. How did you happen to get that job? And did you have to bang your way in, or was it why were they saying, oh, we need a black firefighter, come on in?
Now, this is where community comes in. Again, our teachers always have kept up over the years with our students. We've had students to go north and south and do real great, yet some stayed around here and did, you know, good things. I guess I was among that group that stayed around here. So after service, Mr. R.D. Smith, again, he and the present chief at that time, who was Everett Lloyd, somewhere around 1966 or 67 and part of 68, it started. Mr. Smith was a council person at Chapel Hill Town Council.
So he had some strength in saying, when are we going to get us an African-American on that fire department?
Well, it came up, and this is where I have to credit our former chief, Lloyd, with. Somehow he and Mr. Smith had a relationship, and they talked about, let's give this consideration or see what we can do to get a black in here before all of these pressures and protests come.
Let's stay a step ahead of the game.
Stay a step ahead.
And so, Mr. R.D. Smith, who knows you and knows your talents, and he said, look, I got somebody you might consider, because he would be somebody who would get along and adapt and would be good. He's not going to – I can vouch for him. That was sort of – I'm just making this up, but
– Well, you were pretty much in the ballpark. That's basically the way it happened. And what I understand, he said, well, after he had given Chief my name as a possible candidate, I was encouraged by him, by Mr. Smith, to go and put an application in. I was a little slowful because I was at UNC Hospital, and I wanted to use my GI Bill to go to school. I wanted to go to nursing school.
Oh, well.
Uh-huh. To be just a male nurse at that time. And so my supervisor at that time at the hospital didn't want to change shifts. So Mr. Smith, was kind of encouraging me. And so I left the hospital and went to Triumph Machine Shop in Carlboro because they were paying more money. And I, you know.
And you had Mr. Smith's training in the shop and everything. You were ready to do that.
That's right. So I stayed down there for like a year or so. I put my application in at the Chapel Hill Fire Department. And they scheduled me to take an interview and a test at the law school, UNC law school down on campus. I did that. They interviewed us and all. And one of the questions that came to my mind as we were talking, DJ, is the question was asked, if you were given an order to put a fire hose on people, would you do it? And I paused.
Yeah, golly, what a tough question.
Yeah. Now, I had just gotten out of military service, and we had a little fire training as far as barrack fires.
Right.
And exposure to how to handle fires, because we lived in barracks at the time. So I thought about it. And I said, well, here goes my application and here goes my job.
I got to be honest.
I said, no, sir, I would not.
And what was the result?
And they said, why wouldn't you? You have been given an order by the fire chief to concentrate your hose on the crowd. Why wouldn't you do it? I said, sir, those fire hoses are too dangerous with a lot of pressure. They would injure people. And I said, as a matter of fact, the ones that's handling the fire hose has to be careful and be in control because there's a lot of pressure on these hoses. And, of course, I was thinking civil rights, and you asking me to do something that it would be crossing the line and kind of like betraying my people, you know. And I had very strong feelings about that. I said, well, here go the job. I know I won't be hired. I never found out the question or anything, any discussion.
No, don't even know why they asked the question.
I don't know why they would ask.
Because it might have been that you gave the right answer.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's great. Well, we're visiting with the Reverend Albert Williams. We're doing it in the context of his being awarded the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Service Award by the local NAACP, and he and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Reverend Albert Williams, and we've been talking with him about he grew up in Chapel Hill and went to Lincoln High School, experienced some of the changing times, became the first full-time black firefighter in Chapel Hill. And by this time, this was like in the late 1960s, almost to 1970, I guess, by the time you got on the fire.
That's right.
Fire department.
In 1968, September the 1st of 1968, I was hired full-time.
By this time, what was different about your experience as a young firefighter from that of a white young firefighter who might have come on at the same time? Was it any differences, or you treated just the same, or What was the deal?
Right. It was established by the chief that, you know, they were prepared because they had never had a black firefighter, you know, staying in the quarters. And we are staying together, eating together, and
this
and
is,
all.
But this has been a struggle for some of the white firefighters, particularly some of the older ones.
Yes.
Who'd grown
yes.
up in segregation and just had this idea, we don't eat with blacks, we certainly don't sleep with them.
That's
and
right.
yet they got to do this. Well, how did all that work out?
Well, it worked out. I went in, of course, I had the experience in service going through the same thing. I was put in the room with a guy from Arkansas who had never been slept with a black, and he refused. And we got in a little hassle over that. And, well, he set my, you know, army gear outside in the hall. I said, okay. I went back and set his army gear out in the hall, you know, because if you would, we were both afraid to get really physical. And finally, we settled down. And somehow the Lord had to been in it because we made friends, good friends. Matter of fact, when I got ready to come back stateside, they always picked the guys up on the shoulders and put them up on the what we call the deuce and a half truck, army truck, to be carried off to the train station. Well, he was the one, Covington, I'll never forget his name, Marlon Covington, put me on his shoulder, and tears was in his eyes.
Well, that's a great.
And we, you know, I think I've had that kind of gift to get along with people, you
and,
know,
and,
from
and that
family.
Served you well in the fire department, or were there people who just, I mean, I don't want to criticize anybody who'd been reared up in that old system who would have to say, well, you're a nice young man, but I ain't going to eat with you, or with nothing, any of that going on in the fire department?
In a very silent way, you know. I call, you know, firefighters are peculiar anyway. You know, anybody that's told her when the fire alarm goes off, you run out of the building, and we are in the crew that runs in the building, so you know we're not thinking right. We're not normal. But it's a rare breed, a good breed. Oh, I wouldn't give nothing for that fire experience. So we settled down, and we had our differences because George Wallace was a candidate for president. Malcolm X was here with his flight, and there were mixed emotions, and they've never had a black in the fire department. This was an exclusive male club. You know, it was an experience on both of our parts, but Chief Lloyd worked it around, and the officers made some real good efforts to receive me and you know, remind the guys of who they are and why we're here, the mission of the fire department, and all of these things, being paramilitary.
Right.
You know.
They can direct you. You might, if I'm the chief, I'm able to say to an older white firefighter who can't get used to this, look, an order is an order. And if you can't live with it, we're just going to have to put you in for early retirement, or you're going to have to find another place. I mean, you can say that in the
That
fire
was
department.
The silent. That was the end of the rope, is so to say. That was the, you know, the end. You could seek employment somewhere else. And this is where the town of Chapel Hill, I have high regards and respect for even the Chapel Hill town system now, because it is, I've experienced a real good system, fast system, as far as its employees. We've had some incidents and things through the years. But my respect is very high for the town of Chapel Hill and the way things are handled as far as its employees.
Reverend, we're about to run out of time, and okay. We ain't gotten started into your pastoral career. But one of the things, just in the minute we've got left, talk about being the, now you're retired from firefighting, and you're got your own church that you're minister of, and but now you can't give up the fire department. They made you the chaplain, and I don't think you're getting rich off that job.
Not at all.
What's it like to be now the sort of the senior counselor to a group that you had to bust into?
I think it relates back to the award that I received on the Martin Luther King Day by the local chapter of the NAACP. As far as my service and the effort that I've always tried to make to enhance the community, to encourage people, irregardless of color, you know. This is a thing that I've always made fun of, and I said, well, one meeting out in Cincinnati, Ohio, we had the occasion to introduce ourselves, and I said, oh, by the way, I did, like you, I had a choice of colors on what color I was going to be. But nevertheless, my name is Albert Williams, and I'm from, you know, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and been with the department for so many years. We had this introduction. And the instructor after class, she complimented me. She said, you broke the ice in it.
Oh,
because we had guys that had never seen black firefighters.
Wow. That's great. You know, listen, we got to get together again because we're about to get started on this conversation, but the time's up. It's been my privilege to have a visit with the recent recipient of the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Service Award, Reverend Albert Williams. Thanks to him for his service and being willing to talk about it. Thanks to you for listening. D.G. Martin, Who's Talking? I'll be back here before you know it.